Hello and welcome to an emergency podcast episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. It's Travis, and today I wanted to talk about some of the takeaways that I had from this student loan conference that I recently went to. This is the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, NASFA, conference in DC. It was a great conference. I learned a lot about the current state of student loan borrowing and the future state of student loan borrowing, and I thought it might be fun to share some of it with you. I think I'm going to start with current borrowers, since a lot of the people who listen to this podcast obviously are current borrowers. And then I'm going to talk about future borrowers, which will definitely impact the future of your profession. So hopefully you'll listen to that too. Let me start by saying, as of July 1, the Repayment Assistance Plan, RAP, is now available for signing up. The Repayment Assistance Plan, I call it RAP. You're not supposed to call it RAP, but golly, it's RAP, RAP. It just rolls off the tongue. So whenever I say the RAP plan, I mean the Repayment Assistance Plan. So the RAP plan is theoretically available right now. You can go on to studentaid.gov/IDR and apply. This is a big deal because a lot of people have not been getting interest subsidies since the save interest subsidies stopped a long time ago. And now if you have a low enough payment, you could potentially get interest subsidies on the RAP plan. Now, keep in mind, if you are going for forgiveness, that might not help you at all. If you're going for PSLF, the only thing that matters is the ultimate lowest payment period without regard to interest accrual. If you're going for 20-year forgiveness under the new IBR plan, that is a lot more valuable than, you know, 30 years of forgiveness under the RAP plan that has interest subsidies, but it's an extra 10 years of payments. So keep that in mind that not everybody is actually going to benefit at all from the RAP plan. It's a case-by-case situation depending on what plans you're eligible for. Now, a couple other things are happening. 1% autopay discount. So only 40% of borrowers are signed up for autopay right now. Before the pandemic, it was 80%. The Department of Ed hates that. They want to get that number back to what it was before the pandemic and build the muscle memory of repayment. So they're offering an extra 0.75% autopay discount on top of the already existing 0.25% discount if you've signed up for autopay by September 30th. Now, that date is a little bit problematic because September 30th is before the date of the end of deferment, the six-month grace period for when you're graduating. So if you are a new graduate, the only way to access that autopay discount is by consolidating your loans and signing up for a plan before September 30th. But if you are a new grad, you have to be really careful because if you consolidate your loans, you might have just done away with all of your options for IBR, right? Because you cannot have any loan dispersed after July 1. People that are finishing out right now did not borrow anything after July 1. So this is a real dangerous situation, you could say. You know, only people that are consolidating with the hope of maybe, you know, repaying their loans eventually, that might be a reason to consolidate. When I say consolidate, I mean consolidate with the federal government, not with a private lender, right? So there's so many nuances right now that you have to be so careful about. And the dangers are extremely elevated, is what I would be honest in saying. Because if you consolidate or you take out a new loan after July 1, that is potentially catastrophic because it takes away all options except for the RAP plan, the Repayment Assistance Plan. And, you know, that's not good. That is not good. Theoretically, just to recap here so far, theoretically, RAP is available right now. You can sign up for it if it makes sense. The 1% autopay discount is a new thing, and that is helpful if you are actually on anything besides the RAP plan for most people. I guess theoretically it could help you if you're on the RAP plan and not receiving interest subsidies. But if you're already on the RAP plan and you're already receiving interest subsidies, I do not think this is going to be an additional discount on top of those interest subsidies you're already getting. So this is really only helpful if you're on like the standard plan, IBR, pay, or you're on a RAP and you're not getting any interest subsidies anyway. So this 1% autopay discount is also not that good compared to private refinancing right now. You know, most people have between 6 and 9% interest rates in their federal student loans. If you take a 1% off of that, that is still higher than what people are getting if you've got a good credit score through private refinancing, if the goal is to pay off your loans. Keep in mind, studentloanplanner.com/refi. That's where you're going to find the best refi deals, I think, anywhere on the internet. So if you need to refinance, check out the bonuses there. But if you don't need to refinance, then keep in mind you have a lot of options right now. Oh, one more thing before I talk about vibes. A lot of people have reached out to me and said, I got offered a $50 a month IBR payment. Hot dog. Why did you tell me in the student loan consult that it was going to be $689 a month? Are you dumb, Travis? Like, are you an idiot? Why didn't you tell me about this secret $50 a month IBR payment? Dang fool, I paid $600 for this consultation. Or, you know, are you a moron? So I got a lot of questions or comments like that. Most of them are pretty nice. It was just like, why do I have a $50 a month IVR payment? That makes no sense. That's not what you told me in the consult, or that's not what you told me a year ago, or that's not what my, whatever, my SLP wealth advisor told me, right? So it turns out, sometimes things happen in student loans that are just completely random and make absolutely no sense. And me coming up with a reason of why it's happening is a guess at times until I have a bigger data sample set. And in this case, it was a complete screw up by a government contractor. So what I think happened is that Accenture, which manages the student aid website, just made a massive calculation error and had some sort of disconnect with the IRS auto linking. And a bunch of people that shouldn't have gotten offered $50 a month got it. And then when the Accenture people thought, and this is just me speculating, right? This is what I'm thinking. I'm not saying that they definitely did this, but I'm saying this is what I think happened. I think what happened is somebody realized, oops, we're offering people $50 a month. That's not right. We're going to get in trouble. Let's fix it. And then they fixed it by like disconnecting things and jumping people's payments up in some cases to like standard plan amounts. And that panicked people. And so we had people get this horrible whiplash without the ability to hire a personal injury attorney. I'm just joking. But like, you know, people, in other words, we would tell them, okay, $600 a month is what we're expecting you're going to pay on the pay plan or IBR, whatever. And they're like, hey, I've got this $50 a month plan. I'm like, I can't make heads or tails of that. I don't think that's right. And then people would try to sign up for it. And then it would jump into the standard plan because the payment was wrong. And then we're having to have people reapply again to get the correct payment they should have had from the beginning. What a mess. I don't know why I've done this for 10 years sometimes, because it's just like, punch me in the face, please. I'd like to slam my head against the drywall in my office, but I'm just kidding. I enjoy it. And it's fun to help people. And it's fun to like call things out when things are broken and explain why. So government contractor screwed up. A bunch of people got wrong $50 a month payments. It wasn't right. They're fixing it. If you're still waiting for them to fix it, reapply on the online methods like Student Aid website. The vibe at this conference that I attended in terms of loan repayment was, you know, Department of Ed and Republicans are really trying to make loan repayment simpler. The only problem is for the next 2 years, it's going to be more complicated than what is before. And that makes sense because you have to know about the dangers of the grandfathering clause and the, you know, legacy plans being available. You have to know if somebody's old IVR or new IVR eligible. You have to know about pay and when that phases out. You have to know if somebody is going for refinancing or if they're going for payoff, if there's loopholes where you can get temporary subsidies that are better than what they could get through refinancing. So you have to know that. You have to know about the forbearance rules, the FORB laws, as they might call them, going away and changing in 2027 to going from 36 months, 12 at a time to 9-24. I'll explain what that means in a little bit. There's all kinds of stuff changing and it's a mess, right? And they're going to get it sorted out eventually because the system is long-term simpler, but short-term it's way more complicated and frankly, way more dangerous. So at least for the next 2 years, I'm not going to be able to go set up my telescope shop in the mall. I'm going to have to do the Student Loan Planner podcast because it's going to be really complicated for the next 2 years. And guess what happens in 2 years? An election. Womp womp. So then the rules might change yet again. So we'll see what happens. But you know, we will probably have a change in the House of Representatives this midterms. And then Democrats will have some leverage. They won't be able to change the rules, though, probably unless they flip that, you know, White House in 2028. But we'll see. We'll, of course, monitor those things. So that's current borrowers. Let me talk about future borrowers or current and future students is what I should say, because this is fascinating. Some of the issues that people are dealing with. You know, some people listen to this podcast that are financial aid people. Some people listen that are policy people. Some people who are listening are still in school. So I thought it might be useful and interesting to talk a little bit about what y'all will be experiencing or what students are going to be facing and how scary it is in some cases and how schools are already working on loopholes in other cases. So let me explain some of the things that I took away from this conference. So there's this risk of students being what's called stopped out. So stopped out is somebody who takes a break for a semester, withdraws, like temporarily takes a pause from taking classes and then comes back. If you take a break and even for one semester in a professional degree program after July 1, even if you've already taken out loans and you're grandfathered in under the Grad Plus rules, you are completely excluded from Grad Plus borrowing when you come back. So being stopped out is a major, major risk. It is really, really concerning. And that's something that I think people need to raise awareness. Like if you were in school, you are not allowed for any reason to take a break if you want to get a degree. Otherwise, you'll lose access completely to Grad Plus and will have to go probably to the private market because your lifetime loan limits will most likely exceed $257,500. And so you might not be able to even access the $50,000 professional loans. So that has a huge consequence on people's lives. And I think more people need to know about that risk. There was talk at the conference. A lot of people were concerned about something called schedule reductions or SOAR. So what is schedule of reductions? Basically, it used to be that if you were a part-time student or not full-time, you could take out, you know, a lot of money for living expenses if you needed to, right? And that was made it a lot easier to have a longer period of time in school if you needed it. Well, now that's not the case. Now, if your institution defines full-time as a certain amount of credits and you're below that, they have to lower your aid proportionally based off of the percentage of full-time that you are. And so you've got to be half-time or above too, I believe, to get loans. So it's sort of like, that's a real challenge. So a lot of students are going to have a hard time paying for living expenses through federal loans. Now, what it sounds like is some of the schools are trying to work loopholes around this. For example, in the graduate space, there's not as much definitions and rules about like what's full-time. It's like, so schools are starting to lower their definition of full-time to maybe 6 credits or 9 credits or something in grad school level that will allow them to give the full award because they're able to say, well, our definition of full-time is just way lower. Schools that are trying to work around this schedule reductions, but you know, in general, folks that are in school right now need to know that they need to be going to school like full-time, whatever the full-time definition is. Otherwise, you're going to get aid reduced. There are a couple other observations. There is a Grad Plus cliff that is going to hit some students sooner than expected. So for example, some people, I talked to some dental student financial aid folks, dental school financial aid folks, and they said that some of their students have had to repeat years, right? And so they have some students that are entering their fourth year of dental school that have actually already been there for 4 years. And the way the rules work is starting in July 1, which is we passed now, you are allowed to borrow for the lesser of three years or expected time to credential. Well, if you've already been at dental school for 4 years and you're entering your fourth year of dental school because you repeated your D2 year or something like that, then you've been there 4 years, you're past time to credential. So because 4 minus 4 equals 0. So you have 0 additional time to borrow Grad Plus. So a lot of these students are finding out in their fourth year of dental school or medical school, hey, I've got some bad news for you. You're cut off from the Grad Plus program. Oh, by the way, your tuition is due. It's $100,000. Pay us, please. That is really troublesome. That is really problematic. We're trying to do what we can to help people, trying to do what we can to like make people aware that there are options out there to complete your degree, because the only thing worse than borrowing $100,000 of private loans, you know, is frankly not getting loans at all to complete at all. So that's certainly not what anybody wants. So that's something to really think about, you know, in terms of if you are hit by that phase out, you're going to have to get private loans most likely to finish your program. A couple other things for current and existing students. There was a court case that issued a stay in the professional student definition. So that was restricting nurse practitioners, PAs, PTs, and others from borrowing the $50,000 per year limit instead of the $20,500 yearly limit. And a judge in the District Court of DC said, you know, hey, throughout this definition, just you got to change it to broaden it, basically. And the Department of Ed responded to that by broadening the definition and including nurse practitioners, PAs, PTs, et cetera, in that $50,000 per year limit. But sort of, in my opinion, issuing a veiled threat at schools, basically saying we are probably going to win this on appeal. And, you know, to be honest, they probably will, because they're going to appeal it probably to the Supreme Court. And they basically intimated that they would continue appealing it all the way. And when we win this, which is, I'm saying, Department of Ed saying this, right? When we win this, it would be bad if you were in a position of over-awarding a student, right? So the fear there is they issue $50,000 for loans, and then you have to claw back the $29,500 over-issuance that people got that shouldn't have gotten it. Now, it's just kind of weird because they're talking out of both sides of their mouth, because they said if you've already awarded the $50,000 limits based on the old rules, you don't have to claw that money back. That actually affected some theology students that were considered professional students under the department's definitions, but had that stripped because they basically, because of this definition, they added some professions and took away other professions from the definition of professional student, which is wild. Like that some people got it and some people didn't. The thought process among schools, they're all asking their general counsels as to what the heck they should do right now. Should they issue the $50,000 loans? Should they issue $20,500? They don't know. I was in a session. They said, show of hands, how many schools are doing the higher limits, the $50,000 per year limits? only 10% of the hands went up, give or take. It was a small fraction of the schools that are going to be issuing that higher federal loan limit of $50,000 per year for these professional school status programs that are in flux. Now, medical, dental, vet, law school, those are going to get the $50,000 per year fine. There's no changes there. But if you're a nurse practitioner student, a PA student, something like that, even though this court case is issued to stay, you are likely going to be restricted by your school to borrowing $20,500 per year. That's basically because the schools don't want to get in trouble. They, I think, are afraid of making the administration angry with how litigious everything is these days. And so I would just be prepared that you might need to turn to the private market in those spaces of PA, NP, et cetera. Would that be super damaging to you? I don't think it would be, because if you think about the average length of a PA program, you're not going to have enough debt to be able to get public service loan forgiveness anyway with the new loan limits, because it's $50,000 per year if you're a professional student. So if you're doing a 2.5-year program or something, you're going to have less debt than your income in most cases. So you're by 10% of your income over 10 years, you know, summing up to 100% of your debt, throw on principal plus interest, you're just not going to get really much of anything forgiven through PSLF, even if you borrowed a ton because of the new loan caps. So I would not be super upset about doing private loans if I was a PA or NP. The PT programs are the most at risk, in my opinion, because the $50,000 per year for 3-year programs could really make a difference for PTs that come out with, you know, 80 to 120K type incomes. You're just going to have to think through, okay, I get into my low cost program, I get into my high cost program. For rising first year PT students, you're going to really want to go to that low cost program no matter what, you know, with these loan limits being in flux, because Department of Ed probably will win an appeal. I did get to talk with a lot of different private lenders at this conference, just for, you know, obviously full disclosure. Some of these private lenders are partners on our website. And what my goal is to understand how are these, you know, folks going to try to fill the gap, because there's estimated at a $9 to $10 billion per year gap now for grad school funding. And private loans are not going to fill that gap. So they'll fill some of it, but they're absolutely not going to fill all of it. So if I think about, you know, what should students be doing that need private loans, I would say this. I talked to one person. I said, what did your vet student get? She told me, well, that this vet student got 7% from one lender, 8% from another lender, and 14% from another lender. I'm like, what? And so the variation on the private student loan market right now, because these lenders are operating with very little data and very little experience, the rates are all over the place. I mean, it is really, really wild how all over the place these rates are. So apply a lot of places. We've made a marketplace that's got some, I think, really good deals that you're not going to find other places. If you go to studentloanplanner.com/private, you can see those deals that we've got that other websites don't have. So I would just say apply probably at every lender on that website. If you're applying for a loan for a professional degree, I think you'll find the best deal through our website. I hope. I'm pretty sure you will, but, you know, please apply and let me know. If you find something else better, I don't think you will, but it's possible. So let me know. Travis@studentloanplanner.com. And my takeaway from what the private lenders are doing out there is you've got to apply around a lot. Lenders are requiring, in some cases, 3 years of credit history and a high FICO score of 650 plus, but really they want it to be in the 700s if possible to get no cosigner loans for a lot of the programs. The problem is think about what this means. It means you would have had to have a student credit card in your sophomore year, no later than your sophomore year of college, to build 3 years of credit history and then apply in your first year for no cosigned student loan. So a lot of people don't have that. A lot of people might be a mom and dad's, you know, kind of bank, at least for the first couple of years. Maybe they get a credit card in their own name, junior, senior year. One of the takeaways that I had was everybody should be starting their credit history in college in the first year of college based off of these new loan changes, so that if you ever do want to take out private loans, you've got a credit history so that you might be able to qualify. That was kind of interesting. A couple other comments. Schools are very confident publicly, even though there's lots of uncertainty. One question in one of the sessions was, raise your hand if you're a graduate or professional school and you plan to lower your tuition in response to these loan caps. I think not one hand went up in like hundreds of people in the room. They said, how many of you will lower your you know, tuition next year? Almost nobody's hand went up in the room. You know, at the same token, though, I went to a session for a consultant group that works for schools to like price optimize everyone's net tuition revenue to the school. There's a lot of really smart consultants that work for the school, and their whole model is like, how do I squeeze every dollar out of every student based off of everything we know about them, down to like the granular last 4 digits of the zip codes in which this student's family lives. I mean, it is wild. Like, if people saw the level of insane analytics that go on by these schools and just really the schools hiring these outside experts, right? You would realize, oh my gosh, like this is such a game that like you've got to play to in the aid market. But they were just showing like net tuition or the tuition discount rate, which in the bond market is a huge deal because the tuition discount rate, so everybody has their $50,000 a year tuition. And in reality, there's a tuition discount rate. And the tuition discount rate basically is partly a sign of like how strong the school's brand really is. You think about a Harvard or MIT, their tuition discount rate is next to nil because they don't have to discount their tuition. They've got a wait list a mile long, right? If people want to go there and pay full freight. Meanwhile, your random, you know, middle of nowhere, small liberal arts Christian college in the Midwest, like they, you know, have a maybe discounting rate of 60-70% because they're struggling to stay afloat and they've got to play all kinds of games to try to get enough people in the seats to even stay open with the demographic pressures that, you know, people having fewer children, all those sorts of things that they're being impacted by. So, you know, what I would expect is what happens in the undergrad market is going to flow through to the professional market. What I'm hearing quiet stories of is like grad students and professional students going back to their programs when they're about to be admitted and say, can you do better on this? Can you use professional judgment and give me more need or merit-based aid because I'm getting XYZ offer from other school and that's cheaper. Schools don't discount because you ask generally. They discount because they're worried about you going to one of their competitors. And in, you know, a space of like an in-state dental school where they know they're the cheapest option for you, like they don't really have much of an incentive to discount. But, you know, if you get into a random dental school or random vet med school, you know, they still might not discount, right? Because they might have enough people to go to the wait list and yield everybody that they need to yield for their class. It's just going to be a big mess for the schools because the schools are, in some cases, they have a lot of competition. In some cases, they do not. So certainly in like the pharmacy space, there's probably a ton of room for negotiating. In the, you know, physical therapy space, there's probably a ton of room for negotiating because there's a ton of programs. In the medical school space, where there's probably a lot of wealthy families that would just write a check for the full cash pay amount on the wait list, if you don't want to go, there's probably less room for negotiation. So be thinking about what leverage you have and ask financial aid offices to use professional judgment for your tuition, especially if you're going to a private university for a professional program this fall, because nobody knows what people are going to do, right? It's going to be a learning experience. A couple other things, there's an accountability metric now that says that your earnings for grad and professional school have got to be higher than you're a bachelor's degree holder in your state for 2 out of the 3 years after graduation, basically. I don't think this is going to be a rule that will actually even maybe impact people because it's a rule that doesn't really take into effect until 3 years from now because it's 2 out of the last 3 years. And by that point, the Trump administration will be almost out of office. And if you have a switch of the White House, that rule will be thrown out probably. So I don't really think that that is going to have much of an impact, but they did talk about this a little bit. Overall, there's a lot to know going on in the student loan market right now. I will do my best to keep everybody updated, but remember that these 90-day notices are starting to go out, but they're not going to send them all out at once. They're batching them. So they're sending out a bunch of notices to borrowers every day saying you've got 90 days to switch into a new plan that's legal out of the Save Forbearance. Keep in mind that the forbearance rules have not changed officially yet. They are currently 12-month forbearances for up to 36 months lifetime. The change in mid-2027 is that you can only do 9 months of forbearance every 24 months. That's a massive change. It's going to, you know, prevent people from doing what they used to do on forbearance. But you do have that right until the mid-2027 to ask. So if somebody like screwed up their taxes, filed joint, and they should have filed separate, they're not wanting to mess that up, whatever. There's a lot of tools at our disposal to optimize people's payments. Even if wrap is the only option, there's still a lot of levers to pull that people are just not aware about. You know, I had a lot of fun conversations with financial aid officers just explaining things like the importance of filing a tax return in the fourth year as a student so they can use that as legal proof of income when they graduate. Like just basic loopholes like that that save you a boatload of money. There's still tons of ways to save money. Even when wrap is the only option at all for everybody, there's still going to be loopholes and ways to save money. So maybe the telescope shop in the mall will continue to wait for even after 2 years from now where they expect things to be super complicated, at least for the next 2 years. If you do need a student loan consult, go to studentloanplanner.com/book. I expect a lot of people will have a lot of questions. You can go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail if you want to ask a question for the pod. Thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast, and we will cover more pod episodes as all the crazy chaos with the wrap plan evolves. Thanks for listening.